Welcome to this, our fourth topic in Creative Industries. Hi, I'm Tara Brabazon. In our last two sessions, we explored the nature of creativity and the creative industries. But today we do something really interesting. We investigate the nature of work. But we also introduce a fascinating phrase, post-work. But before we get to the post, we have to go to the pre. So let's have a look at some history. In 1850, Britain was, to use Raphael Samuel's phrase, the workshop of the world. The impact of steam, power and mechanisation transformed the labour process, made goods cheaper and opened up new markets. The changes to labour were simply extraordinary. Men and women became more productive and efficient. In 1860, the British proportion of world production was remarkable. In this one year, 1860, Britain produced half the world's coal, half the world's iron, half the world's raw cotton. One quarter of the world's energy was responsible for one quarter of the world's exports and one half of the world's shipping. Remarkable. This is economic dominance. This growth was created through an industrial revolution. But the cost of this power was great. Work was hard. Leisure time was short. The labour force was exploited. There were also colonial scars where countries like Australia and Aotearoa New Zealand provided raw materials that furthered this British development. Now, we've already mentioned the Industrial Revolution, but industrialisation is a process, not a single event. This process fundamentally altered understandings of work and leisure, and altered our routines of work. An industrial revolution involves a fundamental restructuring of the economy. Rates of economic growth were high. Cheap goods, cheap products were generated. But this was a change. Before 1850, before the industrial revolution really hit, few industries required a large-scale working population. You see, the building of products was done mostly around the home. Domestic industries had irregular hours. Quite wonderfully, there was a prevalence of St. Monday in these domestic industries. What's St. Monday? Well, that's when you take a holiday Monday after a rather large weekend and make up for that weekend by working harder later in the week. But of course, these irregular hours could not be sustained. You see, after mechanisation, precision and discipline were required. So you could no longer have your party Monday. Where have all these ideas come from? Well, Josiah Wedgwood, you know that name? Josiah Wedgwood of Wedgwood Pottery actually formulated what we now know as the factory system. What Wedgwood did was he forced out smaller pottery operators that were unable to handle his new mode of production. What Wedgwood did was he separated out labour into different processes. He created a conveyor belt effect. So what happened was workers were trained in a particular task and didn't move from that task. So, for example, remember we're talking pottery. One worker would make a handle. Another would make a spout for a teapot. Another would paint the teapot. So as you can understand, the quality of the pottery improved enormously. If you're doing nothing but making a spout for a teapot for 30 years, you're going to get rather good at it. But the problem is that the skill level of the workers themselves was very low. So Wedgwood's pottery changed men and women from artists to hands of the machine. Wedgwood's ideas were added to by, you'll know this name too, Henry Ford. Yes, he of automobile production. In 1911, Ford introduced the assembly line procedure. This process was known as Fordism. Fordism. That is a moving assembly line. That is, the workers stay in the same position and the assembly line moves in front of them. Think about the pressure involved in that. The work is moving before your eyes. So high wages were given to workers to attract them to operate in this pressurized environment. Low prices for goods resulted from high volume production. You know the Ford line? You can have any color as long as it's black. So all the product was the same, but it reduced the cost of those cars. So So these new systems of discipline required guaranteed work rhythms and introduced a bell to commence the clocking in process. You may like to think about the social and the cultural impact of workers being called to work by a horn. Workers had become hands for the machine. So Henry Ford and Josiah Wedgwood are known as industrialists or industrial capitalists. What they did was they organized the workplace with efficiency to generate profit. But industrialization is not simply a way of organizing classes. It's also a way of organizing production and consumption. So now that we've put in place some history, let's have a think about theories of work. I think too often we assume a definition of what is work rather than recognizing how profoundly the definition of work and leisure have changed. For example, how work was defined before the Industrial Revolution is different from how it was defined after the Industrial Revolution. But what is amazing, you know, is how many of the ideas from the Industrial Revolution in terms of work have survived to this day. Basically, there are four characteristics of work. Work involves the performance of some form of activity. It involves the payment for that activity. Physical and mental energy is required. But there's also an expectation that that work is useful, thereby distinguishing work from leisure and play. From this simple definition, we already see the ideologies that are enfolded into work about value, about payment, and about usefulness. Such a definition creates a profound separation from leisure. Work, though, is not only a verb, to work, it's also a description of a place, the workplace. It's also the description of an activity, the working day. So it's an adjective and it's a noun. There are many ways and structures through which we can understand work. Fordism and post-Fordism are two of the most frequently categorized periods. The year 1911 is the beginning of Fordism. Henry Ford introduced the 8-hour working day to his assembly line in Michigan. His aim was to increase productivity, facilitating the mass production of goods. Now, the assembly line did succeed in increasing productivity, but it also de-skilled workers. So they were trained at one task and didn't move from that task. There was no focus on training, education, knowledge, or skill development. The emphasis was on how to produce goods in an efficient way, not on the people who produce those goods. A new type of society was generated that worked hard and in pressurized conditions so that they could consume. The problem with this system is that workers started to only gain their identity through consumption because they were alienated from their work. The increase in productivity was justified through increasing income for the purchase of goods. This system was sustained through the boom period of manufacturing after the Second World War. Most of these jobs in Fordism were framed as men's work, particularly in steel and car manufacturing, with women dominating textiles, clothing, and footwear manufacture. From the 1970s, though, economic conditions tightened and the manufacturing sector declined. So enters post-Fordism and post-work. Now, I told you at the start we'd talk about post-work. Let's think about that phrase now. So while Fordism changed labour and also chained labour to external rhythms of the machine, post-Fordism displaced much of what we previously termed work. The acceptance of part-time and casual employment that we have now would have been unheard of even 30 years ago. What has enabled this transformation is the movement from a work culture to consumerism. If you like, shopping is the payoff for a highly exploitative employment without security. So post-Fordism doesn't signal the end of Fordism. Manufacturing still exists, but hospitality, tourism and retail are the growth areas of the economy. Now, these fields were coded as feminine during the time of Fordism. So this is important. the growing employment sectors involve women, while the declining industries were dominated by men. Post-Fordism is characterized by unemployment and underemployment, hyperconsumerism and environmental damage. Words like downsizing, outsourcing, relocation and teamwork started to enter our language. The primary search was for flexibility. The ideologies of individualism and consumerism increased in their resonance. Along with these changes, notions of wants, needs, choices transformed. The positive spin on these characteristics is that post-Fordism encourages worker flexibility, autonomy, and responsibility. But it also creates cyclical poverty for many and builds a service economy of cleaners and waiting staff. So the characteristics of a post-work environment are a casualized labor force, increased free time, proliferation of technology, and an increase in the creative industries. People have multiple jobs, which are more unstable. We also have accepted a particular level of permanent unemployment. At the same time, though, we've accepted the characteristic of a post-industrial environment is an obsession with skill development. So now we're going to bring this right back to the creative industries and look at how work and post-work exists in this new cultural formation. Richard Florida wrote a book titled The Creative Class. The Creative Class. It became a bestseller. It's not really an academic book, but it celebrates for a wide audience the potential changes in the economy that we've talked about today. We've discussed the word class quite a lot in this session, but how did Florida use the word class in his title, The Creative Class? Well, we know industrialization gave birth to a class structure that formed the working class, the proletariat, and the middle class, that's sometimes referred to as the bourgeoisie. But in a post-industrial environment, class does change. Florida assembles a creative class that he argues makes up one-third of the workforce in our current society. It includes those working in design, information technology, educators, musicians, architects, and artisans. But when we go a little bit more deeply into his definition, we also see those who work in the service sector are part of his definition. So you think about this. Is being a waitress or serving in a shop a creative act? Also, is there a unity of consciousness, a unity in a way of thinking that aligns as a class an architect, a musician, a web designer, and a sportsman? For Florida, what links these groups is what he describes as, quote, a passionate quest for experience, end of quote. The creative class describes an intense and diverse set of experiences involving music, cafes, galleries, and restaurants. The link between creativity and creators is blurred. But Florida ignores the part-time, casual, contract labour that makes up this new workforce. Struggle, class struggle, has been cut away from the creative industries debate. Certainly, Florida's passion for those who live a creative and artistic life is understandable, and certainly he does value creativity over consumerism. But the assumption that the underemployed and low-paid people can magically become more creative and they can obtain a supplementary income is displaced. It's not, except for a very few, a site of primary income. Filmmakers, musicians, writers, and fashion designers work in low-income returning environments. These are called portfolio careers, a series of short-term assignments or jobs that build a portfolio, not a long-term supply of income. So as we leave our section on work, leading into our post-work future, prepare yourself to assess another variable in thinking about who you are, in thinking about identity. Next, we investigate leisure.